Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
My great-grandfather, Jimmy Jim Bunham, when he was a drinker, he was a fighter. And when he was a fighter, he often pulled a knife. He also, there's the unfortunate incident of him biting a man's finger off in a fight, which does not fit really great in a cookbook.
No, you can't do that. That finger thing.
Yeah, but you know, I forged on ahead with it.
This week, we are thrilled to have in the house with us the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Rick Bragg. Rick's new book is titled The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table. That hooked me right there, Rick. I have to tell you, it is indeed an honor to have you here on Special Sauce.
No, it's my pleasure.
You know, I usually say, hey, tell us about life at the Bragg family table. And I should say that you can learn all about life at the Bragg family table in both The Best Cook of the World and your terrific family memoir, All Over But the Shoutin'. But we can consider these two episodes the cliff notes or the crib sheets for those books.
I don't think there's much life beyond the family table. There is always food cooking in my mama's kitchen. She makes cornbread every day. The kitchen smells like pinto beans and ham and beef short ribs, potatoes and onions.
Even now, and she's in her 80s.
Yeah, even now. She is even now at 81. Making cornbread every day in an iron skillet. So the kitchen always smells like something good, and it always smells like bacon grease.
Maybe it always smelled good and there was always great food, but the circumstances which you grew up in were not, let's say they weren't privileged.
No, they were. My people were working people. They dug coal. They worked in, if they were lucky, they worked in steel mills, pipe shop mills. If they were unlucky, they swung a pick. They, they picked a lot of cotton. And they did.
Including your mom.
Yeah, my mama dragged a cotton sack all of my childhood. And, she worked as a maid and a, and she took in laundry, and she took care of other people's children, cooked other people food in their houses, and she was a maid. I can't say it was ever easy, but the best part of it was the food.
I wish you'd read this one paragraph that I was so moved by where you talked about what your mother was doing while you and your two brothers were eating.
Yeah, we were ignorant of what was happening there because we were just little. I did not know then, like I know now, that my mama never ate until we were done. Or maybe I did know, but was too young to understand why. I did not know then that she picked all the meat out of the soup and stew and put it on our plates. I did not hear her scraping pots, pans, and skillets to make her own plate, after her three little pigs ate most of what we had. But I can still see her sliding the bones off plates and gnawing them clean after we were done, saying how she just liked the meat close to the bone, that we just didn't know what we were missing. It's not that we were starving, just that the quality of life for her children inched up a little if she did without. Mm.
And it explains so much, and yet you talk about life at the table with great joy.
Well, it was the best time of day. It was the greatest time of day. My people don't think I have a real job because I don't get dirty, or usually I don't.
Right.
You know, I don't get dirty. If you have a real job, you have to pick, comb the cotton lint out of your hair. You have to, you have to get some Octagon soap and wash the grease off your hands. I think they think I cut out paper dolls for a living, something delicate and easy. But for those folks, my folks, the reward was, especially the worldly one, was being able to come home. They ate their lunch out of a sack,
right,
mostly, but being able to come home, and it might be very plain. It might be beans and cornbread, sliced tomatoes, maybe sliced onion, maybe some greens. It may be something from a garden, or it may be in wintertime, it may be fried potatoes and and white beans. But it was savory.
Yeah.
And it was good.
And you talk about your great-grandfather saying that he believed that supper should be the finest time of the day. A reward. A reward for what?
For being able to bear up to it. You know, I don't want to try to be melodramatic, but these were folks who dug wells. These were people who really did dig ditches. They risked their fingers, hands, and arms in the machines at cotton mills. You know, they worked in, 140-degree heat routinely. And to bear up to it, to survive it, 12-hour shift, maybe you're working in the dark all day. Maybe you're just staring into that Alabama sun all day. That time when you get in the door, and, they always ate early. They always ate, often they would bathe and then sit down at the table and eat early because they would be asleep by 9 and they'd be up by 4.
Wow.
So supper was often really hellishly early.
Right.
You know, for my folks.
And people really relished it, everybody.
I can never remember. And I'm serious about this. I can never remember anyone in my life sitting down at a table and acting disappointed.
So great.
I never remember anybody saying, like in summer, we didn't eat a lot of meat. In summer, we ate a lot of really fine, green beans with new potatoes, coleslaw with red cabbage, and again, great cornbread, maybe with some pork cracklings cooked into
right.
it, melting into it.
I know. When I read that recipe, and we'll get to that later, I was like, I need to have some of that now. And I believe that if you were a responsible author on a book tour, that you would come into every interview with a pan of that.
It's been said that I am selfish and I have gotten too big for my britches.
Okay.
And you're right. And the only thing I can tell you is I will fix it by the paperback.
Excellent. You became a writer, right? And you say, actually, you talk about it in All Over But the Shout. And it's not like, oh, this is what I want to do. It was almost like, this is what I could do.
Well, I wanted to be a lot of things. At one point, I wanted to be work in the investigative division of the Alabama State Troopers. But unfortunately, they determined that my mental health did not lend itself to law enforcement.
I wish they would hold those standards as high today.
Right. Well, apparently I was not fit. And apparently it had something to do with anger management. And then I wanted to be, more than anything, I kind of wanted to be an architect. And I haven't talked or written a lot about that, but I loved the idea of designing structure.
And nobody in your family had, maybe somebody had graduated high school, but nobody had been to college.
My daddy went to sixth grade. My mother went to sixth grade.
Wow.
I was the first member of my family to graduate from high school. And I thought maybe I could learn drafting, the fundamentals of and be an architect. And I did great at it for about 4 months until I found out there was math involved and failed miserably. And a friend of mine, a boy named Mike Ponder, who is a lifelong friend, we buried him not too long ago. He's a great, great friend. He said, hey, you need to take journalism. We don't do nothing in there. And I said, what do you mean? He said, we don't do nothing. We just sign out on the board, say we're going to work on a story, and then we just don't do much. And I thought, well, okay. So I took journalism but found out that I knew I loved storytelling because I'd grown up with the best storytellers in the world. I mean, those blue-collar people, the foothills of the Appalachians, can spin a tale. But I learned that you could get a check for it in journalism.
Now, were your parents storytellers or not really?
They were. My daddy was not. He was a man of action. He had been a Marine. He was a fighter. He was a hard drinker and a, you know, he was a reader.
Got it.
He was a reader, but he was not a writer.
Yes, yeah, there's that scene in All Over the Shouting where he gives you the box of books
right.
He's really, really sick.
Right, and I would learn that he was even more. Yeah, the last time I saw him alive, he gave me that box of books. But I would learn later that he was often he would find a quiet place anywhere he could. You know, families were big, houses were small, and he'd find a quiet place with a paperback. And he would read everything. He'd read Zane Grey.
Right.
He'd read Tarzan.
Right.
You know, the Edgar Rice Burroughs.
So he's indiscriminate.
Right. He'd read everything. And my mama was not as big a reader, but she was a talker.
Yeah.
And she was.
Which you capture beautifully in the new book. So.
Yeah. Thank you. But she was. It is truly has to kind of be laid at her feet because
she was a sort of minimal. Seems to me she was sort of a minimalist storyteller.
Right,
she would never take 200 words to tell a story when it could be told in two sentences.
Right, whereas I take a story that could be told in two sentences and often take 200 or 2,000 to tell it. The beautiful thing with Mom is she has this great sense of irony. And sense of humor, even about dark things. She is a very sensitive and in many ways a kind of quiet, almost sad woman in what she's endured. But her sense of humor is just not killable.
And probably enabled her to keep on keeping on.
I think that was part of it.
So journalism seemed like an easy way to get some credits.
Right.
But then you must have discovered that there was something of meaning that you could do
right.
Within its, you know, within the four walls of journalism.
I found that, I was a sports writer for a little while
mm-hmm.
Because they didn't want to trust me with, anything serious like the library beat or anything like that. So I did a lot of, sat on a bench and did a lot of high school football games over the years.
And you say you spent 6 months in college,
right.
You know, which may be generous.
Well, if you add it all together, yeah. I mean, you know, it's there's no point in just being picky about it.
I'm sorry, I was just trying to do my homework.
You can't make some people happy. I had two semesters. Unfortunately, I only finished one, and I only took one class that semester. They honored me at my hometown by they gave me an honorary doctorate, but they also gave me my transcript from my year.
So you could expunge it from your record?
It had, and I'm not making this up, it had on it an F minus and an incomplete. I don't even know how you get an F minus.
Me neither. I always thought that was one of those things from a movie.
Yeah, no, you. It is. I have it. It's in. They put it in a nice red leatherette binder.
So great.
And just I guess to show me how grateful I should be for my honorary doctorate. I did find out that you could tell stories about people with the color and the imagery and detail that my people, my uncles, my aunts, the old people in my family, told them about everything, and that you could tell them with that color, that imagery, and maybe you could put a human face on issues and tragedies and that kind of thing. So I did a lot of that.
Yeah. I mean, there's this great quote I'm also maybe going to have you read where you realize what you thought that you could do with journalism, which is this chapter here.
I was slowly beginning to realize that the only thing that was worth writing about was living and dying and that trembling membrane in between. I've never been a ghoul. I have been so sickened by killing and dying that sleep was just one more dream in a bed at 4 a.m. But even then, I was drawn to those stories. There is something about the rich darkness of it, of that struggle by people at risk, people in trouble, that made all other stories seem trivial. They were the most important stories in the newspaper. I wanted to write them, and only them.
So give us an example, even in the early days, of those kinds of stories.
Well, for instance, a congregational holiness preacher who had gone to prison for killing his wife, strangling her with a double ligature tied in a shirt. Well, he claimed all his life he didn't do it. He claimed and he begged and he protested and he did his time. And he used to baptize prisoners in the trough at the state cattle farm. And he got out and he went home, but people shunned him because he was the preacher who killed his wife. Much later, there was a great deal of evidence to show that he was right all along.
Really?
And we were not able to clear his name in court, but we were able to do a simple, long news feature that he could hold up in front of others. And it went a long way toward clearing his name. But mostly I did people in trouble. You know, I moved from Birmingham to the St. Pete Times, which is great. Did a piece about a little boy named Dirty Red, who was, his mother called him that because she would give him a bath and he would immediately cover himself in effluvium. And he was arrested for hurting a little girl, sexual assault. He was like 4 or 5. And the deputies down in Broward County took him to jail, put him in rolled up the legs and the arms on a prison suit and took his mugshot. And then they found out, well, no, we were wrong. They found the real culprit. And they just kind of dumped the kid out on the curb and never bothered to explain. Said it wasn't their job to explain to anybody in their neighborhood that the boy was innocent. So that's when I thought a story could have real power.
Yeah.
You know, the mama took the big stack of newspapers that I sent her and handed them out, you know, and stapled them to telephone poles. And I love stories about people in trouble. You know, I went to Haiti, wrote about the killing and the dying. During the Aristide, when Aristide was kicked out of the country. I did a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, and you wrote very movingly about Liberty City in Miami when you were...
Hard not to write well about Miami. Hard not to write, do a good job writing about
Miami. I know.
Miami.
It's like Carl Hyacin has the best, platform.
He's a cherry picker, isn't he? I mean, he's just picking cherries.
Carl Hyacin is, of course, the great novelist and humorist who... uses Miami as a backdrop.
Oh, yeah.
In a great way. What's interesting, even in All Over But the Shoutin', you know, there's still a lot of stuff about food, you know, mm-hmm. like your description of breakfast.
Right.
You know, it's like, it seems like that although journalism, you wanted to tell one kind of story, that food has always grounded you. Would you say that's true?
I think it's absolutely true because again, food was the reward. And there was also some small amount of moonshine involved, of course, in my family history.
Right.
But I think the food was that one thing. And I think I say in the book that sometimes it seems like my South has kind of lost its heart. But our food, sometimes it seems, is the best part of us.
Yes, and it's constantly changing. And the food of the South, I'm good friends with John T. Edge.
Sure,
been on And so he talks to me so much. I've learned so much about food in the South, not only historically, but these days. And it's very different. It is the beating heart of the region in many ways.
I think so, yeah. I think the main difference between me and John T. is he actually knows what he's talking about when he writes about food. And what I wanted to try to do when I wrote about food was to write about the stories behind it, because no meal was ever accomplished, none, without a story.
Yeah.
And I don't mean what'd you do today, dear?
Right.
Not that kind of story,
right.
but you know, did you hear old so and so got shocked off the wall of the warehouse? Fool should have known not to cross those wires. And we hear things like that, or fishing stories, or hunting stories, or snake stories.
Yeah, or you tell a lot of hog stories.
Well, hogs are essential. You know,
they are indeed.
A hog is a noble beast. You know, the one rule in our family was, don't name them.
Yes.
Just don't name them.
You wrote, there's this another paragraph where you mention hogs when you write about breakfast that I'd love to have you read, which is the second paragraph on that page on the left.
Sure. The one great meal of the day was breakfast, because breakfast is cheap. Every morning of my childhood, I woke up to the smell of biscuits and to the overpowering aroma and popping sound of frying fatback, which we called white meat. Mama fried eggs laid by our own chickens and made gravy and grits. Sometimes there was nothing but biscuits and gravy made from yesterday's bacon grease, which I would take right now in place of just about anything I usually eat. We always had a hog. Not hogs. A hog. And at hog killing time, we ate like kings until he had been reduced to snout and toenails. If I was late for the school bus, she would shove a piece of fatback or bacon into a biscuit, and I would eat it on the run.
Hmm. I mean, when I read that, I was, first of all, obviously very moved, but also it made me hungry. I wanted to be at your breakfast table, Rick.
Made me hungry just now. So.
I mean, and that's what's so interesting, that in the midst of all the struggle, food was a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. The very worst thing that could happen is that you could somehow be bamboozled and marry into a family, male or female, who did not love food. And if you do not love food, then you probably can't cook food, or you're not interested in food. And that's what happened in our family. My grandfather married as his father said, son, you married a skinny woman who cannot cook. It's your own damn fault. And it was a near tragedy in our family. He married a young woman for love. And her kinfolks had laid a trap for him. They had wanted to get her out of the house because she was ill-tempered and she was a little peculiar. And they wanted to get rid of her. So they faked a box supper. The young ladies of the town at like a barn dance, would go and they would sit on a chair with a little box of food that they presumably had prepared. And we were a very progressive place, and men would bid on them. Bid on the box lunch,
right.
But they would also get the pleasure of the company for however long it took to eat a couple of chicken legs. And he bid in good faith, and he greatly enjoyed the fried chicken and pie, and I think it was biscuit. Everything was great. And then married my grandma, Ava, to find out that he'd truly been like hoodwinked.
He'd been bamboozled.
He'd been had.
By the box lunch.
Right. He had been had. And he proceeded to starve because she had no interest. She was about as big around as a popsicle stick, which I guess is not round, but anyway.
Right.
But she had no interest in food. And he was from that culture where food is your reward. And in desperation, he brought in a bunch of old women to, you know, great, great aunts, you know, great cooks, to teach her how to cook. And she ran them all off. I mean, she was strong-willed and a little bit mean and tough. And she ran them all off. So in even greater desperation, as a last chance, he thought, who do I know that can cook but is mean enough to stand up to this woman? And unfortunately, that person had to flee the state after an unfortunate knife fight that May or
you just let these things roll off. Well, the knife fight. And well, you have to flee the state.
You know,
this didn't happen in my childhood.
No, believe me, that my great grandfather Jimmy Jim Bunham was he was a fighter and a cutter. He worked on like logging crews, and he snaked logs out of the mountains with mules. He was a tough old man.
Yeah,
but he was a drinker. And when he was a drinker, he was a fighter. And when he was a fighter, he often pulled a knife. He also, there's the unfortunate incident of him biting a man's finger off in a fight, which does not fit really great in a cookbook.
No, you can't do that. Yeah, you can't do that finger thing.
Yeah, but you know, I forged on ahead with it. And but he was the man.
Yeah.
He was the one man who was hard enough, mean enough, and just could not be ruffled.
Yeah.
He was just that Southern man, you know, in a bushy mustache and a old slouch hat, who you never saw his eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, through a lifetime, you didn't get a good look at his eyes.
Wow.
Which was good because they were frightening. There's a picture of him in the book. It's
really
terrifying.
Yeah.
And my grandfather, again starving, fetched him, went into the mountains, said, "I married a pretty woman who cannot cook, and I'm starving to death."
Wow.
And his daddy, I guess out of pity, or maybe he was lonely, I don't know, he moved down the mountain, and he moved in with them.
Wow.
And commenced to teach my grandma how to make. Now, you tell it the way my people tell it, it's a great story. If you say, "Oh, yeah, we had to go get this old man to teach Grandma to cook,"
right,
then it's not a great story.
Great story, yeah, for sure. So, Rick, we haven't even gotten into the nitty-gritty of the best cook in the world, Tales from My Mama's Table, but we're going to have to leave this part of the conversation right here because we've run out of time. And we'll pick up on that subject, the best cook in the world, on the next episode of Special Sauce that we're going to do with you. So thanks so much for making time for us.
No, it's truly my pleasure, although I am a little hungry.
And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.